You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
It's that time in the show where we light them if we got them. So, what are we smoking this week, Brad?
This week, we're smoking a little treat, a little precursor, if you will, to the Southern Cigar Festival that we'll be attending in June. Part of buying our tickets, we were able to score a complimentary My Father cigar. So this is
So that's another thing. If you don't want to pay the ridiculous Ticketmaster upcharges, if you go to the actual store, which is Cutters and Alpharetta, to buy your tickets to the event, you get a free cigar with your ticket.
Yep, absolutely. So this is the My Father Lounge exclusive. This is my first time having this cigar. And I got to say, you know, here in the first third, I'm getting a lot of leather, a lot of coffee out of this one. Very distinct flavor, very different than some of the other cigars that we've reviewed.
Yeah, and I've not really tried any of the My Father Cigars brand. With the Lounge exclusive, though, it's something they do for their special retailers that have what they call a My Father Lounge, so that you can only get these at those certain cigar stores. And from what I've read about the cigar, because like I said, I've not smoked the regular My Father, so I can't really compare it. But they say it's similar, but it's got maybe a little bit more strength to it. They say it's a completely different cigar than their standard My Father line.
Yeah, and I mean, with this cigar, you're looking at your Ecuadorian Habano wrapper, and I gotta tell you, man, I love my Maduro, but I'm starting to become a big fan of Habano. I mean, it just seems like there's a little bit more spice, a little bit more kick, something when I'm not craving the sweetness of the Maduro.
Yeah, it's kind of got the strength without the sweetness to it, and it does definitely has almost a more like complex flavor profile than, like, say, your standard Maduro.
Yep, and, we got a Nicaraguan binder, Nicaraguan filler, a little bit smaller than the typical cigars we would smoke. This comes in at 5 3/4 inches, about a 50 ring gauge, and, overall, I mean, this is a pretty decent, sit outside on the patio or the lounge, just kick back and relax. I mean, I see the cigar probably taking no more than maybe 45 minutes to smoke. So,
I mean, we'll see how long it takes us here. Yeah. If we make it through the entire
segment. I say this is probably going to be a two-cigar episode. but overall, like I said, have you noticed the wrapper on this? I mean, it's very tight, very neat and clean compared to some of the other cigars we smoke. So I'm kind of digging the construction of the cigar overall. I mean, I don't have anything bad to say as of right now, which, granted, we just fired it up probably about 5 6 minutes ago, so we're well into the first third. Curious to see what we got coming up in the second and final third.
Yeah, definitely. I said it's a nice little bonus you get for to go with your cigar tickets to the event. And this week is it's one Brad's been talking about doing for a while, and he finally taught me into it, the Fast and the Furious episode. So, yeah, I'm usually furious, but I'm rarely fast. It's, yeah.
Slow and steady wins the race sometimes if you break down.
All right, well, that, folks, we'll be right back with the main segment.
Stay tuned.
What are you smiling about?
Dude, I almost had you.
You almost had me? You never had me. You never had your car. Granny shifting, not double clutching like you should. You're lucky that 100 shot of NOS didn't blow the welds on the intake. Almost had me? Now me and the mad scientist gotta rip apart the block and replace the piston rings you fried. Ask any racer, any real racer. It don't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning's winning.
Oh shit, we got cops.
And welcome back to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're about to get fast and maybe a little furious up in here.
Yeah, I see this episode going by really, really quick. Yeah, and we're not going to stop with the puns here, so it's going to be a continuation.
This week we're, you know, since Fast and Furious 7 came out not too long ago and is making stupid amounts of money, apparently, we thought it'd be a good time to do...
billions of dollars worth of money? Hells yeah.
Yeah, we figured it'd be a good time to talk about the Fast and the Furious franchise and also, you know...
I mean, dude, I just got a passion for cars, so, I mean, this episode kind of suits my geekdom to do with the automotive industry and everything else, so, I mean, I not only do we get to be a little bit nerdy, but, you know, there's going to be some awesome, you know, I guess run-ons with different beers, and so, I mean, we get to talk about beers, cars, babes, and just general manliness.
So that's why you're rocking the Vin Diesel haircut now?
No, I believe I'm rocking the Vin Diesel haircut due to genetics. That's because I grow three hairs.
Well, you know, let's talk about, you know, what came before Fast and the Furious, and then, you know, the general genre of quote unquote car films. I mean, there's been a, you know, ever since there was, you know, cameras and vehicles, people have wanted to put vehicles and cameras together and make badass movies. I mean, you even see, like, way back in, like, freaking old silent films with, like, you know, a little, you know, Model T running over people and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, well, vehicles and stuff like that, transportation in general was real big back in the Prohibition era. I mean, like you're talking about with the Model T and stuff. I mean, that was groundbreaking technology then. So, you know, that revolutionized the way that, you know, folks got around, and, you know, at some point people just weren't satisfied with having the status quo, so they figured out how to tinker and tweak with engines and modify things. And, you know, I mean, the same progression that we see with the Fast and Furious franchise, I would say, is the, you know, basically a synopsis of, you know, the 100 years or so evolution of the automobile.
And there's always been, I would say, you know, it kind of hit its height in the late 60s through the early 80s. I mean, there are several movies that, you know, well, just about every movie has a car in it. But, I mean, there was several movies where the, I would say the cars themselves are almost a character in the movie.
Well, I mean, you saw that with the movie Christine by Stephen King. Or, you know,
a bit less literally, yeah. But yeah, that's definitely a movie with a car as the character.
I mean, and you had Herbie. I mean,
yeah, Herbie. Oh, dude, I forgot about Herbie the Love Bug.
How can you forget about Herbie, dude? I mean, that's like one of the biggest staples. I mean,
that's why everybody wanted a VW Bug back in the day.
I mean, not only that, but they were cheap. They were easy to modify, and I mean, dude, I can remember, you know, one of the very first car projects I started with my dad. I was probably, I don't know, 10 or so, and we took an old 60s model VW Bug, took the body off of it, stripped it down to the frame, and made a pretty badass rail buggy out of it. So
those, that and two, they were so light you could, you know, pick them up yourself. I mean, my dad told me a bunch of stories about how they had a teacher they used to always play pranks on that had an old VW Bug, and him and a couple football players could just, like, pick it up and put it in random locations just to annoy him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hell, you see that with any kind of small vehicle. I mean, dude, I can remember with some of my buddies had a Geo Metro. I mean, and it's about a bug size equivalent of a car, just a little less bubbly. And it was so bad that you would have to turn off the AC and roll up the windows and everything for it to pull itself up a hill.
But then, like I said, we had stuff like...
I mean, you had a lot of animated series. Yeah. You know, Japan was real big, and...
Well, Speed Racer.
Racer X is
as important as Speed himself, you know? If he was just driving random cars each week, it wouldn't have been nearly as cool as having the, you know, the Mach 5. But back in the 60s, we had Bullet. Bullet and Vanishing Point.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Vanishing Point is still considered one of the best car chases in a film ever. I mean,
speaking of which, I need to go back and rewatch that again because I'm like once again playing it in my head. And I'm like, oh my god, I'm having nostalgia. So
yeah, and basically that was the whole thing. And was it Death Proof? Quentin Tarantino.
Yep.
If you want to get to a more modern version of that, is that?
And I mean, we even saw with some other anime stuff. Initial D was another anime series that evolved around kind of street racing, car culture, and stuff like that. So. I mean, all throughout history, people have had an urge to go fast.
And then film it.
Hey, guys, watch this. I mean...
I think that's one of the reasons why the car film genre is so popular, is you get to see people doing stuff that us as a daily driver really can't do without going to jail or...
Or, you know
being
what?
In, you know, on a racetrack.
Or at the same time, maybe it's...
And also you get to see cars that, we may not be able to afford or get your hands on, but, everybody can put in American Graffiti and watch some of the badass 55 Chevy do some crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, I think that, your biggest event that I can think of that fits this culture is probably the Nopi Nationals. I mean, that's really where most people are going to be able to go and actually see drifting and see, the types of cars that are on films and stuff like that and, the people building the vehicles. I can tell you I was down at the World Congress Center a couple of years ago, and it was basically a supercar event. And just seeing, $1 million vehicle sitting there and stuff, it's just absolutely mind-blowing, that machinery and the mechanics behind that.
Yeah, I mean, living up in Dawsonville, we get the Moonshine Festival every year, and basically the whole town gets shut down and turned into one big car show. So,
and that's awesome because that basically, there's always a big debate between the old school musclehead hot rods versus the new school tuners and stuff. And I mean, me personally, I don't care. I like the both ends of the spectrum. I mean, see a car and it's got, big ass, dual headers and everything else. And, I mean, I guess for me, it's a cargasm.
So why do you think that the car films have always has been so popular throughout, modern history, at least?
Because just about everybody throughout history has had an opportunity to own a car. And anybody that's owned a car, I don't care if it was the biggest POS.
I want to go fast, mama.
at some point, you get a little Ricky Bobby in you and you want to see what it's going to do. I mean, and it's not necessarily a, being young, dumb. It's just... I guess the adrenaline rush, and it's everything that the first time you got your license and you were able to get behind the wheel.
Yeah.
I mean, do you remember the experience, the freedom, and everything else that came with that?
Yeah, living here in the South, anyone who's ever driven on a dirt road wanted to be the freaking Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeehaw!
We were drifting before drifting was cool.
Although I will say drifting on a dirt road does not necessarily work well because the gravel is just going to make you go in a straight line.
I don't know, you go around a dirt road curve, you're going to do some drifting. It may not be the kind of drifting you want to do.
Yeah.
But it's, like I said, it takes a little bit of skill.
I could tell you a couple of, oops, I think that was a mailbox story.
I did pull a Dukes of Hazzard stunt one night in my grandfather's 4x4 truck. This road I would go down to go to the girl I was dating at the house at the time. There's one of those signs that says, bump in the road. And, well, the reason why there was a bump in the road, apparently there was, like, a burst pipe and the road just kept swelling.
Uh-huh.
So it really went from, like, a small bump to a big bump overnight. So I'm usually doing it in my little Nova. Well, I'm driving his truck, and I'm like, bump ahead, slam on the gas. Well, like I said, that bump had rose, like, a foot overnight, and I hit that thing and went full-on Dukes of Hazzard, like, wheels off the ground. If I had had a horn that would play Dixie, I would have had to hit it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, too. I mean, I guess throughout this segment, I think we need to disclose that, one, obey all traffic laws. Two, these are trained professionals. Unless you're a trained professional, don't get out on freaking Georgia 400, thinking you're going to, hit that quarter mile in 10 seconds. It just ain't going to happen.
Yeah, there's too much traffic for that shit now.
Yeah. I mean, and, I think that's the other thing, too, that really makes so many of these movies appeal because... Like you said, we can reminisce about you know, 10, 15 years ago when you could get on a back road and, you know, get away with stuff. Or, you know, it was a small town cop. Everybody knew everybody and, you know.
Yeah, because I mean.
Yeah, it might be a slap on the wrist and I'm going to drag you by your neck to your parents' house and then let them beat your butt. But now, today, you don't have those luxuries and, you know.
I mean, back 20 years ago when, you know, we first started driving, you know, there was. There was a lot less cars on the road and also a lot, you know, less, you know, people doing dumb stuff.
And I mean, we had less technology. So, you know, I almost want to attribute to this. I mean, this might be an interesting study for, you know, people that are into polls or science or whatever. But, you know, all the kids today basically obsessed with electronics, burying their face in laptops and tablets and whatnot. Dude, when I was that age, I was out driving golf carts, go-karts, four-wheelers, dirt bikes. I mean, you know, I was out cutting trails, you know, through people's woods and backyards, and everybody just saying, yeah, here, have fun, and you don't get away with that stuff today.
That and too, when we were getting cars, we didn't have, you know, parents buying us a freaking brand-new Mustang. Like, you know, you had a car, you worked on it yourself, you knew the limitations of your machine, because you're the one that had
to. No, I didn't, because I kept trying to push them, that's why it always broke.
But like you said, I think we, like, most of us grew up, you know, driving, you know, dirt bikes, lawnmowers, whatever you could get your hands on that had wheels, and so by the time you did start driving, you had some more experience than, you weren't going from having no car to having a... basically a race car overnight and not learning the mechanics and responsibility of it.
Absolutely. So,
I mean, there was, I mean,
dude, I love that quote. And, you know, the first Fast and the Furious film where, you know, Brian and, you know, freaking Toretto are going down and, you know, they're racing. I think it's Brian's big first race, against, Dom or Toretto, ever, how you want to refer to him. And at the end of it, you know, Dom walks up and is like, dude, what are you smiling about? You know, you lost. And he's like, no, I almost had you, man. And I love that line. It's not whether you win by a, yeah, you almost had, no, you didn't even have your car. And yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is a lot of people think you could just get out there and you could just, you know, put the pedal to the floor and that's all there is to it. But no, there's a lot of mechanics. There's a lot of, you know, as a person, how to handle, you know, the different forces and, you know, the reaction speeds and everything else that it takes to get your car from point A to point B when you're in that position.
Yeah, and that when I was doing dumb stuff on back roads, I didn't have to have a laptop plugged into my car. I mean, they weren't nearly as complicated as they are today. I mean, it's the...
But I almost wonder, though, is it that complicated? Or are you relying on somebody that's a developer to say, hey, this is what I'm looking for as far as my performance. I plug it into the, you know, OB2 sensor and everything, upload, you know, this program. Or if I've got a chip, I'm going to, you know, just replace that chip with this more enhanced chip. I mean, what happened to the good days of, you know, being able to turn wrenches? I mean, you couldn't actually see the, you know, fuel to air ratio. So you had to...
You had to tinker.
Actually tinker and get it dialed in. You had to listen to your car. What is your car telling you? You didn't just get a whole bunch of digital readouts. And I guess for me, you know, it's cool to see all of that stuff in films and, you know, in some of the car shows and everything. But, you know, there's a certain side of me that, dude, I just want to know the fact that from point A to point B, I was able to get the most out of this machine possible.
Yeah.
And it's all through, you know, my own effort and torque wrenches and the pain in the ass that comes with it, the bloody knuckles and
well, in the, you know, like I said, in the modern era, we've definitely seen a resurgence of the car film, like with was it Gone in 60 Seconds was probably like the first big modern car movie that I can think of, and then I already mentioned, you know, Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof. But then in 2001, we get the first Fast and the Furious movie.
And I can remember everybody after that movie. I mean, it seemed like high school went from just whatever folks could get their hands on to you really saw the Civics, the Preludes, and that type of stuff absolutely blow up. I mean, I can tell you, you know, our entire auto tech class, there was no textbook learning. It was people bringing in their cars, us learning what worked, what didn't work. So, you know, we got a lot of hands-on experience in auto tech, but I mean, it was really like all just freaking imports after that movie came out.
Yeah, because, I mean, there'd always been an import scene in you know, Japan and stuff. But really...
Well, I mean, I think there was one, you know, I wonder...
It was limited here, but like, well, it didn't get like.
I would say here on the East
until...
Coast, but you know, talking to my friends out on the West Coast and stuff like that, I mean, it just seems like in this culture, everything starts west and migrates its way east.
Well, at that time, you know, those cars were, you know, not everybody can afford a 68 Camaro, but you know, most people could, you know, get their hands on a freaking whatever VW Jetta or, you know, whatever Mitsubishi
Honda Prelude, Honda Civic. I mean, dude, I can remember probably one of the funnier moments in auto tech in high school is my buddy had gotten, his parents gave him a Saab, like Q93 or something like that. And he's like, it had a stock turbo engine. And he's like, dude, I want to put a blow-off valve. So he put a blow-off valve on the thing, and you couldn't hear the blow off over the, you know, just the normal sound of the engine running at idle or anything. I was like, yeah, what you were looking to achieve is not what you've achieved at all. And I mean, it was just really, really funny for that moment.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the reasons why the you know, tuner craze blew up is because if you want, you know, to go six, you know, a 10-second car using like American Muscle, you're going to have to spend a lot of money.
Well, but I mean,
with a Japanese car, they're.
Let me ask you
this.
And
the accessories weren't, you know, you may put $20,000 into it versus, you know, $60,000.
I mean, you know, the other thing I think is funny about this is you didn't have terminology like 10-second car, you know. That was all Hollywood's doing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's so much car culture that Hollywood tries to, you know, influence. And I'm like, that's not real world at all, but it makes good, you know, for theatrics. And I think that's ultimately what appeals with, you know, the Fast and the Furious series for me is it's so theatrical, it's so over the top, that it's just fun.
Yeah, because, I mean, there was always a drag racing culture, but you didn't, you know, because, well, you know, this first movie was very much a drag racing style movie.
Absolutely. I mean,
and like I said, they've been drag races since, you know, the 50s.
The first movie really reminded me, have you ever been up to Commerce to the drag strips there? I mean, I can say went up to the drag strip, and that was back when the, you know, TV show Pink's was on and stuff like that. And, you know, they would do some filming and stuff up there at the strip. And it was always pretty cool just to go up there. I mean, you would see a lot of folks just, you know, with their everyday car that they had tinkered with. And then you would get, you know, a couple of jet-powered bikes or something like that that, you know, just to see something move at that speed was just, you know, awe-inspiring. And the sound of the engines is just... I don't know, man. It's truly an experience.
Yeah, but yeah, to me, that's one thing. That's one thing because I've always been an American Muscle guy. Yeah, I want my supercar. I can appreciate the tuners. You know,
dude, don't lie. You just want to be able to put your foot on the throttle and do wheel stands.
Yeah. Well, see, I want my car to sound like a car. I don't want it to sound like a flock of pissed off bumblebees. I mean, nothing beats the rumble of like a freaking big dual exhaust on a V8.
V12, V10.
But yeah, you know, in the first Fast and the Furious movie was actually based on an article called Racer X about Japanese street racers is where they kind of came up with the idea. And what was cool about that first movie is it was, from the start, you think it's a race car movie, and then it turns out it's more of a crime movie. It's almost like Point Break, but with cars.
That's a good comparison.
Yeah, instead of the FBI agent having to go undercover as a surfer to get into this surfer gang, it's the LAPD detective going undercover as a street racer to figure out who's robbing these trucks. And it was, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it 15 years later, Vin Diesel, Dominic Toretto, and his gang are street racers by day and street pirates by night.
Yeah, you know, it was funny watching, you know, some of the outtakes and stuff, and also listening to what went into the production where they actually had to modify 18-wheeler trailers and stuff for the cars to be able to go under them and stuff. And
yeah, because you always see that trick in the movie, going up under... If you've ever rode beside an 18-wheeler on the highway, there's all kind of crap that hangs underneath. No way you can fit a car underneath there safely.
By no means do I have a street racing machine, but I've got a small coupe, and every time... I'm sitting next to an 18-wheeler. I'm like looking at the trailer like, there's no way my car's going under here.
No. I don't care how low your Honda is. It's not going to make it. You're going to get an instant ragtop if you try it.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of the old Smokey and the Bandit movie. Daddy, Daddy, the roof fell off.
I did see them do that on Mythbusters one time to try to see if that would actually happen, if it would just cleanly cut the roof of the car off if you drove under a semi.
I mean, I think if you had enough momentum, it could potentially work, but...
I think they actually did it. It like I said, but...
Yeah, I don't know, because there's a meme going around, and, it was basically a big 18-wheeler rig, and... The rig itself makes it, but the trailer's higher than the rig, and it smacks into a bridge.
Yeah, I think I've seen those. Yeah, it's look where you're going when you're driving a semi.
There's a reason there's clearance signs.
Yeah, but yeah. This first movie was like you said, Paul Walker playing undercover officer Brian O'Connell, trying to get into the street racing culture, and it was. I don't know. Like I said, it wasn't just a dumb car movie. It had like...
No, I mean, like you said, it had not only good action, but a good story. And, you know, throughout the franchise, they've been able to progress that. And I would almost...
The creation of the cars and the work that goes into making a street racing car and that whole... we don't see as much of that over here on the East Coast, but that L.A. racer... culture. It definitely, dug deep into that. You could if you were a street racer, you could definitely identify with this, with this movie.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing is I would almost say that I don't think that coming at the age is appropriate, but, it's definitely one of those that the character progressions. Yeah. Like, there's a certain realization that who I thought I was is not really the guy that I think I am, and everybody's perception of me, they have no clue what I'm really capable of, what I'm made of.
The conversation in Fast and Furious, the fourth movie, where Mia asks Brian, she's like, are you sure you're the good guy pretending to be the bad guy, or are you the bad guy pretending to be the good guy? And he's like, I really don't know.
Absolutely. And you see a lot of, inner searching of oneself in all of the movies. I mean, that was one of the biggest things about, Brian and Dom's relationship in the very first movie.
Yeah, because
you think you're just some buster off the street that's going to come in here and be able to, box with the Incas and...
Yeah, because that was just, through most of the movie, he did not want it to be Dom. He's like, no, it can't be Dom. It's got to be one of these other street racers.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be, freaking Johnny Chan and his crew.
Yeah,
or...
I mean, even once he does find out it is who, he's his man, he, can't bring himself to actually arrest him. He, gives him the car and lets him get away at the end.
It's so easy to sit there outside of certain situations and say, okay, you did this to this person. In this case, I think he took a freaking 3/4-inch tire iron or something to dude's face that had wrecked Dom's father's car. And
yeah, but then you at first you don't find that. And then finally, Dom tells him, like, this guy basically killed my father. So you can understand where he – that's the good thing. Dom and them are definitely criminals in this first movie, but you want to like them. I mean, they make them – enough where you're I get it. I understand.
There's a vigilante outlaws. I mean, by all intent and purposes, you had Johnny Chan and his crew, freaking do the drive-by and take out, what's his name? The dude that drove the
Jesse.
Jetta. Yeah, Jesse, right there in the parking lot. I mean, it was in front of the house. And, all throughout that movie, I was like, I hate that character from the rip. Like you said, you truly wanted to like the gang.
Yeah. And the thing that I think you know, that's another thing that's weird about the Fast Furious franchise is we don't really see movies getting up to like eight sequels.
No, dude. I mean, I almost attribute this to like, you know, the freaking Jason series or something like that.
Like
where
Freddy and Jason is the last.
It's not going to die.
It's like the last movies I can remember, you know, going to 8, 9, 10, 11, however many Jason's up to now.
And, you know, we'll get on to it later, but, you know, they've confirmed that they're doing 8 and whatnot. Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, I'm waiting on Brian's kids to grow up, get his license, and the series basically start over with a new generation. Yeah.
That was the thing, you know, back in the day, movies didn't really get you got like the main movie, you might got a sequel. Then trilogies kind of became popular, and that's the whole thing now is pretty much everything is a trilogy, and then after the trilogy's over, they reboot it, you know, and start over again. But with this, I mean, they just keep progressing.
But I mean, and we'll get on to this later on, I think, but throughout the progression, it gets more and more away from the grudgy, you know, turning Grinches, car racing to almost having like a freaking James Bond-esque feel to it with these.
And I think that's one of the reasons why this series has continued and not gotten stale is because each movie is a whole different genre, really.
I mean, it's
like this first movie,
so much more over the top than the previous one.
The first movie, I'd call it a crime movie. The second movie, I would really call that a buddy cop film. You know, that's you know, pretty much it's you know, Lethal Weapon, but with cars. Because you know, with you know, Brian, you know, in the second one, Brian is now a wanted man because he let Dom go, and they charged him with, you know, aiding and abetting and all this other stuff. Well, they capture him and like, all right, we'll clear your record as long as you help us go undercover and bust this drug dealer. And he brings in his buddy Tyrese Roman Pierce to be his partner, and those two are just bickering back and forth through the whole movie. And it's like I said, it's literally a buddy cop movie.
Yes. And I, you know, that aspect of it is the characters are really likable, the dynamic of the characters, and you know, I mean, like you said, you could almost see it as, dude, if we took you and I and five or six of our closest friends, I mean, we could all relate.
Yeah.
Except for the part where, you know, in the latest movie where they go to Dubai and stuff like that. I just don't have the money to go there.
Yeah. But yeah,
but yeah, I mean, so you talked about one and two. So then we get technically the third movie. I didn't realize the short film existed that basically tries to segue, you know, Too Fast, Too Furious, to Tokyo Drift. But apparently,
well, that's the thing is, like I said, the first two movies had two different. You know, first one was done by Rob Cohen. The second was done by John Singleton, which is, you know, you may know him from Boys in the Hood and the Tupac movie Poetic Justice. You know. And then finally, when the third one came out, we got Justin Lin directing. And from there on out, the movies are all kind of connected. Like, one and two could almost be a standalone movie.
Yes.
Like, and then when we got to, like, the third movie, Tokyo Drift, that one was almost like a whole new film.
I mean, that was almost like, here's what I envisioned. Here's the comparison I draw. You had Halloween 1 and 2. Your main, you know, antagonist was Michael Myers. You had Halloween 3 had absolutely to do nothing with Michael Myers. It was a voodoo curse or something, and it did not fit the
At this point, you know, this was still kind of early in Vin Diesel's career, and Vin Diesel was like, nah man, I don't do sequels. I mean, that's why he probably wasn't in the second movie, and they're like, well, there's not really a whole much more we can do with, you know, Brian. But because like I said, he had done up until this point, like I said, he'd just been doing one-offs. Even when he did Triple X, it doesn't come back for the sequel. It's like, yeah, he at that point, he was like, nah, I don't do sequels. And then he's freaking...
So I never realized that. So.
Yeah, because that was one of his things back in the day. He's like, nah, man, I don't do sequels or whatever. But then he did Pitch Black and Riddick and all that stuff. And he's like, all right, I guess I can do sequels and make a lot of money on them. So he comes back for the fourth movie. But yeah,
I mean, he made the third one for like that 30-second clip.
Yeah, that one probably is like the third one made movies have made like good money, but that one made like the least amount of money because it was really no one that you had seen before in this movie. Because, you know, if you watch this one kind of takes place out of order, you know, number three is actually would be number six, really, you know, it kind of takes place after six and before seven. So at this point, no one knows who Han is.
So we're kind of doing that Star Wars thing now.
No one knows like who any of the characters in Tokyo Drift are. It's just like, let's just put cars in a movie and call it Fast and the Furious and people will come see it, which they did, but it's not as many as the other. And like I've said, you know, each movie, not only does it change kind of genres, it also changes racing styles. Like first one's drag racing, second one's street coursing. The third one, or as the title says, drifting, which at that point, yeah, didn't know a whole hell of a lot about drifting. And so this was kind of a intro to that for everybody. And now you see freaking drifting all over the place.
Americans got their first introduction into what a rotary engine truly is.
Yeah, and when, like I said, little Bow Wow, I forgot about the Hulk car he drives.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing about these movies, too, is, I mean, you had... You know, freaking Ludacris, you had Little Bow Wow, like
Tyrese.
You get all these, you know, different rappers, and I'm surprised Exhibit hasn't made an appearance in a.
You'll probably be in number eight. They're running out of rappers. And hell, there's Ludacris music in the first movie, so they're probably like, we like his song. We need to get him in here to be in it. That's how he ended up in the second movie. And that's, like I said, the first one he's in as Taj, the tech racer, race organizer guy.
Yeah.
But like, and you know, also this third movie, it's kind of a coming of age film. Like I said, it's, you know, what's his name? Lucas Black, who played Sean Boswell, the lead in this movie, is a young American who has gotten a bunch into trouble. And now he pretty much has to go live with his dad, who's a naval officer in Japan. So he doesn't go to jail. And he kind of has to learn how to take responsibility.
And I think that was like the one rule, like no racing here, son, or something like that. And
that's the first day he's like drifting and tearing up Han's car.
Yes. And, you know, he almost had that, you know, that Vin Diesel would like, oh, yeah, you guys keep your Japanese tuners. I'm going to take my, you know, American muscle and show you what it can really do on these corners.
The guy he races at the beginning of the movie and gets into trouble is the dude from friggin' Home Improvements.
Is it?
Yes, it's whatever the oldest son from Home Improvements.
I did not draw
he's the douchebag with the Viper that that they end up getting into a fight with. Yeah, and this also is like a freaking Yakuza Japanese mafia film too.
Yes.
Especially the head mafia guy is Sonny Chiba, who was like, you know, famous for all these samurai movies and stuff, you know, back in the day.
And I mean I think that's really where.
And he smokes a cigar through the whole movie too, so
yeah. He's gonna have to at least get, you know, some sort of recognition or
speaking of cigars, remember in Too Fast, Too Furious, the test that Verona gives them is they have to go get this package from his car that's an impound. Whoever gets back first gets the job. And it turns out it's a cigar and his cutter.
It's Cuban.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was kind of the funny thing about Fast and the latest movie is, you know, the big cigar humidor and everything. It's like, you have whatever you want. Don't touch the Cubans.
Yeah. But yeah, then we get into, because Justin Lin pretty much directed like the last.
And I think, you know, there toward the end, like you said, with the third film becoming the Japanese Yakuza style film, I think that's kind of what set the pretense for the whole underworld, you know, tones. Yeah. And then that's basically, I guess, what 4, 5, 6, and 7 kind of build off of, because at that point they go from.
And then pretty much Lin directs. He directed Too Fast, Too Furious. I mean, not Too Fast, Too Furious, Tokyo Drift. But then he also did 4, 5, and 6. So they all kind of have a cohesive storyline where one kind of goes into the other. And, you know, 4 was your straight up vengeance movie. Finally brings Han into the group.
Yes. That's where he gets his official introduction and everything. And, you know, 4 was quite interesting too, with this is the one where Letty ultimately, you know, has no recollection of anything that's happened.
Four,
or is that 5?
4 is where she dies.
So 4
she
is where everybody.
6.
Okay, so that's where, you know, originally she dies.
Yeah,
and
supposedly Brian now has gone, and since he's been cleared, is now working for the FBI. And Letty comes back and tries, and is kind of like an informant for him, trying to take down this other drug kingpin in exchange for getting Dom cleared. And she ends up getting killed.
Oh, yes, because this is one where they're trying to track down Bagra.
Yeah.
Or Bagra.
Braga.
Braga. What?
So yeah, they she ends up supposedly getting killed, and you know Vin Diesel comes back, and they go on like a straight up vengeance spree. So like again, it's a entire different genre film, and in this one, there's what maybe one like actual race scene, but I mean, and there's still like a lot of car stuff, car chases, whatever. But racing isn't as important in this movie as it has been in the previous three movies. It's just kind of
no. I think this one is the one where you know everybody's learning what their individual roles, responsibilities, and how they're going to play into you know this new life that they're taking on. Instead of being the outlaws, now all of a sudden they're kind of the mercenary, I guess, good guys, even though. There's a lot of collateral damage.
Yeah, well, like I said, with this one, because yeah, the whole story of this one is, you know, they're hiring race car drivers to drive drugs from Mexico, and so you know, and this one too, they also kind of went away from the tuners too. I mean, there was still some Japanese cars in this one, but there was a lot more American muscle in this movie and like classic hot rods and stuff.
I mean, you got to bring that balance to the mix, man.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted that that 71 Chevelle SS that Dom drove in the yes. movie.
That's such a sick car, too. In fact, I went to Hobby Lobby before we started working on this. I was looking at some, you know, like 30 model hot rods and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, I'm going to buy several kits and beef up the engines and do some hell wicked yeah. stuff. So. I don't know. May end up with some Mad Max, you know, style shit before I'm done.
I did see, I don't know if it was real or not, but was it Power Wheels? We're making Mad Max Power Wheel toys for kids. And it's like a Power Wheel version of the Mad Max cars.
I mean, I'm not going to hate on it, so. All right, back to the topic hand.
Yeah, that one came out in 2009.
Yeah. And then we get Fast Five in 2011.
Yeah, and that's the first one where we have Dwayne The Rock Johnson playing U.S. Diplomatic Security Service Agent Hobbs, who yes. is the man trying to bring you know, find Toretto, because at the end of the last movie, you know, he got caught and they were gonna ship him off, even though he helped bring down this drug dealer. But Brian and the crew breaks him out of prison, so now they're all outlaws again. And this one is your straight up Ocean's 11, but with cars. I mean, this is a straight up heist movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is straight up, like you said. I mean, Ocean 11 is an awesome comparison to this film. I mean, and this is where you really start seeing some of the over the top antics of yeah. it's no longer street racing per se. I mean, yeah, it's there, but this is just how over the top can we just, you know, car culture taking down freaking airplanes and all kinds of shit.
Well, that's in number six where they take down the airplane.
This one's a big ass tank.
No, this is the one where they steal the giant safe full of like $100 million.
And, oh yeah. And that's the other thing. Like, dude, they got two cars, right? They got this big ass safe strapped to them. Yeah, that safe is like taking out buildings and stuff. And those cars never even swerve.
Hey man, it was Dodge Chargers, man. Some modern handling. I mean, but yeah, I mean, this movie, like I said, was your Ocean's 11. You even get that of them having to bring together a crew of the elite. So you get Roman back from Too Fast, Too Furious. You get Ludacris back from Too Fast, Too Furious. You get the Han, of course. And you also get the hot Israeli girl from number four that was whatever Baraga's personal assistant or whatever that kind of hooked up with Dom. So like I said, they've at this point, you know, they've brought back the crew from all the other movies and into this, you know, one film. You even get what's his name? Vince from the first movie.
Yes.
It was the first time we've seen him back, yeah. You know? And like I said, they're
and I mean that was kind of the thing too. Like with the first movie, you wanted to hate Vince up until the scene where he gets stuck on the truck and you know ends up getting a couple of rounds of shotgun through yeah. him, and you know you get some sympathy for Vince, and then through this one, like all of a sudden it's all right. We put all the bad blood behind us, and
yeah, this is the one where you start seeing that that these people aren't a crew; they're a family. I mean, like I said, that's from here on out. That's yeah, that's like kind of like the theme of no, that you know, we've gone past being a crew. We are family. I mean, this is the one where you find where I believe Brian and Mia like find out they're pregnant or whatever, and you know, said
yeah. I mean, because up before that, there was some you know instances where you know, Brian and Mia split because, you know, Mia's under the impression that, you know, hey, everything that Brian said he felt, it was all just an undercover act. And I think this is the movie where,
we're there together.
It wasn't an act. I'm sorry, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But yeah, like I said, this they're stealing from some big drug lord that's got $100 million safe, and all the cops are corrupt except for one girl. And you finally get that badass fight scene of Dom versus The Rock.
Dude, that's a badass scene. I mean...
Oh, yeah, they beat each other to a freaking standstill. But then, once, The Rock arrests them, his team gets ambushed, his whole team gets wiped out except for him and the girl, the Brazilian cop. And he finally, like, all right, I will help you take this guy down. And, that's when they kind of get the...
Yeah, I mean, at that point, they've got common enemies.
Yeah, at least, respect, if not, forgives. And then he's like... I can't let you go, but I'll give you like a 24-hour head start as long as you leave the money. And they're like, as long as you leave the safe. He's like, all right, we'll leave the safe. And then it turns out the safe's empty. They all jack them. They switch the safes and jack the money and stuff.
Yeah, dude. I mean, there's some awesome gamblers. I mean, not only were they winning the races, but they jacked the money from the safe. Like, dude, like those guys had major, major cash flow coming in without ever having to boost a truck.
Like, yeah. Oh, and then I said, from there we get, Fast and Furious 6, which is, I would say that one is a James Bond movie. Like I said, again, they've switched it up, and this is like a straight up spy movie. There's some kind of international terrorist, Owen Shaw, that has like a crew of badass drivers and stuff, and no one can take them down. So Hobbs, The Rock, goes and hunts down Toretto and his gang, and it's like, hey, we'll give y'all a pardon and, and clear all your crimes.
Immunity for everyone,
as long as you help me take down this terrorist. And this really is like a weird James Bond movie, because his whole deal is he's trying to steal all these parts to build something called a nightshade device, which is almost like an EMP thing that will shut down like an entire city's electricity. So it is that, weird, over-the-top Bond villain type plot.
Hey, if this gets into the enemy hands, it expels extinction for the world. So,
yeah, I mean, that was straight up something you'd see in a James Bond movie. And this, too, is the first one where we just started getting ridiculous over-the-top stuff. I mean, the safe was bad enough, but in this one, like I said, the whole crew is back together again, except for the two Mexican guys, or Dominican guys from the other... They're still, like, gambling away their money they won, they stole in Brazil, so... They didn't return, but pretty much everyone else returned at this point. And like, there's a car fight scene with a tank. I mean, like, this is the point where shit just starts getting ridiculous.
Yes. I mean, it was 5 with the airplane, wasn't it? So 5 had the airplane.
Yeah, that's the big climax is the guy is trying to get away in a plane, and he has kidnapped Brian's wife at that point. So they
He's got Mia.
So they capture him, but then he's like, I've got your family, so they have to let him go, and then they kinda try to take down the plane, and they're shooting planes with grappling guns and weighing it down with cars, and it just gets stupid.
Yeah, and I can't remember the details, but there was one scene there that I was just like, that didn't make any sense, because I think at one point the plane's loaded with all these military-esque style vehicles. Well, all those vehicles somehow get removed from the plane, and so you take away 4 cars that are probably heavier than these little imports, add 2 imports, and the guy's like, we can't take off, we're too heavy. I'm like...
Well, it was pulling down the wings or the flaps, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But this is also the return of Letty, because at this point, like I said, there's a... Well, post-credit scene in number 5, you see The Rock finding out that these pictures of her with this criminal. And it turns out that, when we thought she was dead, she just ended up getting, like, hit in the head or something and ended up getting amnesia. So now she has no idea who she is, and she's been hired by this... terrorist guy. So not only do they have to take him down, Dom has to like convince her that, hey, you're part of my family,
And that was kind of Dom and Letty, their relationship, I mean, it was not the lovey-dovey. I mean, it was certainly, there was a level of respect, but I mean, Letty gives Dom so much shit, like,
she's definitely
throughout
the boss
all the movies where it's like, what's that? I smell skanks. Like, it seems like anytime another female gets within, like, 10, you know, feet of Dom, she's like, bitch, I'm going to fuck you up.
Yeah, and at this point, too, he was, you know, he had, like, hooked up with that Brazilian cop, Elsa, I think her name, or maybe that's...
Yeah, because, I mean, after that, he thinks this, you know, at the time, I didn't realize they were married or whatever, but apparently they are, and later on, we find out.
Yes. So, yeah, at that point, like, I think she's even, you know, Dom's even, you know, living with her and stuff, and when they find out Letty comes back, he immediately... kind of like, sorry, my wife's still alive. So, which we don't even know we don't find out they're married until the next movie. But yeah, he's like the big badass to everybody else, but like she is like his boss. I mean, that's
yeah.
He's like, you can be a badass anyway, but when he's dealing with Letty, he's like, all right, babe, yeah, whatever. Just don't hit me again.
I will destroy the world for you. It's just such an awesome dynamic too. I mean. I don't know. I'm waiting on Fast and the Furious 8 for there to be a Groot reference somewhere in there.
Groot in 60 seconds. Yes. I saw a picture today. It was like worst conversation ever, or most boring conversation ever. And it was like a table, and it was Groot, Hodor from Lord of the Rings, not Lord of the Rings, freaking
that movie, yeah.
The TV show on HBO.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. Timmy from South Park. Pikachu. And one other character that only says, like, one word. I forgot who the other character was, but...
And a mime.
Yeah, it was all these guys that don't say anything, trying to have a conversation. That's like I heard they're going to do...
I am Groot. Pika Pika.
That's like I heard they're going to do a Michael Myers versus Jason movie. I'm like, well, is this going to be a silent film? Like, neither one of these guys talk. I mean, how the... That was the good thing about Freddy versus Jason, is, you know, Freddy could do all the talking.
Yes. interesting. Well, that was an interesting tangent.
Yeah, but in this movie, like I said, eventually they win the day, stop the bad guy, get pardoned, and they actually go back to L.A. to the house from the first movie. It's kind of, everything kind of comes back around. They're all back, you know, one happy family again, except for, you know, what's her name? The Han's girlfriend, the Israeli girl. She ends up dying in this movie, and this is where Han finally is like, "I got to get away from all this raw. I think I'm going to go to Tokyo," because that was their big plan. They're like, "We're doing this last mission. We're going to retire. Let's move to Tokyo and kind of settle down." And since she died, he's like, "Yeah, that was our plan. I'm going to go do that anyway." And this kind of leads into Fast and the Furious 7, and even then, because like I said, to go back to Tokyo Drift, we see the scene where Han dies in the auto accident. Well, at the end of 6, there's like kind of like the post-credit scene of that accident and him dying. And turns out it's not an accident. The car that hit him was driven by Jason Statham, who turns out to be Shaw, the guy they jacked up in this movie's brother. And now he's out for vengeance. So like, it ended up tying in the movie that we've been like, has no connection to anything else to the main series finally.
Yeah, that's the thing, is, you know, these movies they do typically go out of order, and I didn't know it up until today, but, you know, doing our research for the episode and shit like that, discovered that Vin Diesel directed a short film that kind of, you know, ties, you know, some of this stuff together.
Yeah, there's actually two short films. There's one called Turbo-powered prequel, or
Turbo
Prelude.
Prelude, yep.
Yeah, which kind of shows what happened between the first movie and the second movie. And basically, like I said, Brian ran from L.A. and went across country, like, making money on all these, like, street races until he gets to Miami.
Yeah, yeah, you see him, you know, he's debating on, all right, I got New York, I got Miami, and he, last second, ends up in Miami. So, you know, it was kind of interesting to see that. Because I was like, all right, that answers some stuff.
And then the other one, which was Bordeleros or...
Yeah, the Bandoleros.
Yeah, Bandoleros. The Los Bandits. Bandoleros. Yeah, that one kind of shows the prequel to the big heist scene at the start of Fast and Furious 4, where they're still in the gas.
I mean, at this point, they're, you know, in the Dominican Republic. Yeah. It gives a little bit of the background of... hey, you know, due to the tycoons and, you know, rising oil prices, food, gas, everything is hard to come by. I mean, they're just in a very poor area.
Yeah, and it shows Dom, you know, bringing Han in and meeting the two Dominican guys and Letty coming. They're
like,
coming
okay, we got to break this one dude out of prison so we can go meet with Elvis and, you know, discuss, you know, what we're going to do about this gas situation.
Yeah, it's about like a 20-minute prequel that was actually written and directed by Vin Diesel,
which was you know, pretty cool. You know, the actual film is shot mostly in Spanish, so there's a lot of subtitles. But I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, it definitely answered some questions that
it
does, like,
give a little bit.
How
more
did we
of that,
get here?
Yeah, more of that story, and that brings us into the huge movie. I mean, this movie here, the Furious 7, is the biggest one so far. I mean, it made $1.4 billion. And it's only been out, what, 4 or 5 weeks at this point?
I mean dude.
It's still in theaters, I think.
I mean, man, you had so many big names in this one. I mean, dude, you had Jason Statham, you know, Kurt Russell, you had freaking, you know.
And that's one we didn't talk about, too, talking about car films, is the Transporter series. So, I mean, this is the perfect series to bring Statham into, because he's been doing car movies since, you know, and that's pretty much the first things we saw him in was
since Hot Fuzz.
He wasn't in Hot Fuzz,
or who was that in Hot Fuzz? I don't remember. I don't know.
That's the freaking Shaun of the Dead guys.
Ah, yes.
What fucking movie are you thinking of?
It's, I don't know.
But yeah, the Transporter is what I'm talking about. But yeah, and also the remake of The Italian Job was another big, you know, car movie. But yeah. This one, I would say, if the last one was a James Bond movie, this one is basically the freaking Avengers, but with cars. This is almost like a weird superhero movie.
I mean, there were definitely a lot of larger-than-life, unrealistic, when they break
jump
into
a couple-million-dollar car, like, across three buildings.
Yeah.
And getting in a car chase with a freaking drone in the streets of L.A. Stuff has just gotten stupid at this point.
I don't know. Or that one scene where, you know, freaking Vin Diesel jumps his car off, you know, the top of this building at the freaking attack helicopter. And it's like, oh, crap, I missed. But conveniently, I have this backpack full of hand grenades. So
yeah,
that
just kind of like hangs on the door as he's flying by.
And then you see Hobbs, you know, freaking take
shot
and
shoots down a drone with a...
Well, no, the drone got shot down. Oh, he had the freaking Gatling gun or whatever the hell was on the front of...
Yeah,
the drone at one point.
What? Yeah, didn't he like jump the car onto the drone or something? Like,
The ambulance. Yeah, he crashed the ambulance off the bridge
into the drone, and then jacks the machine gun and shoots down like
after
the other
he's
drone
been in the hospital with this freaking, you know, shattered arm and everything. Yeah. Like, but I guess if anybody's going to pull it off, it's going to be The Rock.
Of course, that's why I want to see another G.I. Joe movie with him in it. But yeah, this one just had the most ridiculous stuff. We had the whole jumping cars out of airplanes because they have to go. Kurt Russell is some kind of secret black ops CIA type guy, and he's like, "I will help you take down Shaw if y'all help me take down this terrorist and free this hacker that has some kind of they call it the God's Eye program, which is it's almost like the
it's basically this program that takes over any kind of communication device, whether it be traffic camera, cell phone. If you're within,
it's almost like the thing from Dark Knight that Batman builds, where he can hack anything with a speaker and look for the Joker. It's basically like the same thing, but yeah, they they build some kind of freaking off road charger and drop all their cars out of a plane to chase this dude down.
And that was probably one of my favorite scenes in that movie, where he's like, okay, you see the old school muscle car, and then you see, you know, this freaking, you know, militarized, you know, armor plated SUV, and he's like, I want the godchild of these.
And of course Ludacris is like, all right, he's like, but all that armor's not going to go very fast. And he's like, this time it's not about speed.
Yeah.
Oh, but
and dude, the freaking cliffs, and I'm just like, how the hell does anybody survive that stuff? Like,
and I think this movie too, since this, you know, Paul Walker died during the making of this, they did a good job of kind of memorializing him. And
yeah, I mean,
that was one thing I worried about, because I was like, are they going to kill him off in this movie, or what, but no, he survives the whole movie, and they kind of do. If they wanted to end the series at this point, they did a good job of saying, kind of wrapping up everybody's thing and saying goodbye to Paul.
Hey, we're all settling down, and you know, dude, I gotta say that this was probably the film that had me on the edge of my seat, and you know, also too, like, emotionally involved.
Yeah,
you know, knowing that, all right, Paul's dead, so how do they play all of this stuff out? And I mean, it was one that truly had me sucked in. And I mean, there were the moments where it was like, damn, that's heavy. And then there were the other ones that was like, holy crap, I'm freaking mind blown just because of special effects and how awesome that was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was a good mix between emotion and action in this film. I mean, it was extremely well balanced.
I figured this was going to be the last. But, I mean, they've announced that there was actually plans to make 10 movies. So we may still get another, you know, 8, 9, and 10, or at least.
Well,
one.
I mean, they've already confirmed.
Yeah, they definitely confirmed number 8 because
and set to release in 2017.
Yeah, and Vin Diesel even said that, like Paul said, you know, it's guaranteed we're at least going to do an 8. So he's like, I feel like since Paul said there's going to be 8, I have to do 8. You know, I don't know if it'll keep, because originally I think this was planned to be the start of a new trilogy of films, but with him dying, I don't know if the plans have changed or not. But they're at least doing number 8. And I heard Kurt Russell's character is supposed to have a lot bigger part in this one. And I think this was supposed to take place in New York as well, because that's like probably the one city they've not been to in any of these movies is in freaking New York.
So I was just kind of reading. So, you know, the last one was titled, you know, Furious 7. Is this one going to be titled Fate?
Maybe.
I don't know. It's something I kind of read, and I was like, I wonder.
I do like the running gag about Belgian beer in this movie, too.
Yes, and that's something that, you know.
when Vin Diesel first meets Mr. Nobody, is what they call him, he's like, the dude has this badass base with all these cars and weapons
he's
and stuff.
He's got 2 kegs of freaking Belgium.
Yeah, like kegerator's like, here, have a Belgian beer. Like, these are really good. He's like, nah, man, I only drink Corona. And he's like, well, I knew that. And he pulls out like a bucket of Coronas for him.
Yes.
And then like later on, Kurt Russell gets hurt. And he's like, Dom, you think he's dying. And he's
yes.
like, I got to tell you one thing. He's like, what? You really got to try this Belgian beer, man. I swear it's good. It's like this whole thing. He's like, keeps wanting him to freaking try Belgian beer.
Yep, and I mean, that was the one thing that...
He's like, if we survive this mission, I'll switch out one of my kegs for some Corona, man.
Yes. So, I mean, and that was, I guess, one of the parts that was awesome, just to light humor and us being the...
Yeah, if they don't have, you know, Paul Walker's character in the next one, because I think his brother filled in for some of the scenes that they needed to film, so you know, but... At this point, like I said, he's got 2 kids at this point in the series. They could easily say, all right, he's retired. He's got a family. He can't be doing this dangerous shit with us no more. And you have him.
Well, who's to say there's not a short film or something out there that elaborates on, you know, after we see in Furious 7 where, you know, Dom goes one way, Paul goes the other way and rides off into the sunset.
Which that's the kind of how they ended the,
you know,
the movie.
Who's to say that, you know, somehow, you know, I mean, because reading the articles, you know, it says that Paul Walker, for their longest time, said, oh, yeah, there was going to be a Fast and the Furious 8.
Yeah.
So,
like I said, I don't know if they're going to, like, try to get somebody to fill in for his character or just, like I said, at this point, it's very easy to say, all right, he's no longer in the game anymore. He's off living with his family, and the other guys are going to go get into shit. But if they're going to, you know, like they've said that... Kurt Russell is going to have a bigger part in the next one. I like that the dynamic with him and Vin Diesel. So
yes,
like I said, he could maybe take over the buddy the buddy part of it, because I mean those two characters together just I really enjoyed in this last movie.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean Furious 7, by all means. I mean it brought to me what kind of the first movie did with, you know, the whole family building and everything else. And like I said earlier, you know, it was just an awesome combination of action, emotion. I mean, it was one film that I could say, hey, even if you're not a car person or a big action film person, this is one that you could sit through and, you know, truly appreciate for everything that it brings to the table.
And it's continued to make money, too. I mean, the total... budget for all seven movies at this point was $759 million, and it's made $3.8 billion. Which, most of that coming from the last movie, but like, they've all been like super, super profitable. So I can see where they'll keep doing this as long as they can.
Well,
make money.
I mean, dude, you know what's been a successful franchise? I mean, I didn't realize how many video games this franchise had spun off. I mean, I knew, like, you know, Need for Speed, although it's not a true Fast and the Furious, I mean, it had that feel to it, but. You know, I mean, apparently there were Fast and the Furious drifting games, there were circuit games, there were racing games. Apparently in 2013, there was a console and PC game release for Fast and the Furious.
I never played the Fast and Furious games. I didn't know about that. So, as we're kind of wrapping up here, you know, what do you think the secret to the success of these films? Like, why is this still making tons of money?
I think because people can relate to the characters. The characters don't seem so larger than life. I mean, dude, it reminds you or reminds me of a group of good friends that, I mean, the fact that they're willing every Sunday to sit down, have a meal as a family, yeah. come together, and even though through all the shit, like, they always have, you know, some kind of prayer or something else that they're, whether they're praying to the car gods or they're yeah. actually praying to, you know, the Lord above or whatever, I mean... It just brings a sense of, you know, I guess family or something. I mean, that's kind of the thing, I think, for me,
the secret of it is the innovation they do. I mean, each one of these movies is a totally different movie. I mean, the characters stay the same, but like I said, each movie is something different. They're not just rehashing the same shit over and over and over again.
No, I mean, it's not... It doesn't feel like a reboot, a remake, or anything else. I mean, it truly feels like you know what you're going to get. I mean, it's been successful. You're going to get a good mix of action, emotion, and at the end of the day, I haven't left one of the movies and been like, damn, that sucked. So, I mean, I think it's going to continue to be a successful franchise. I'm curious to see how it evolves and grows over time and everything. So... I don't know. I still think that we're going to get Fast and the Furious 9, and it's going to be, you know, the second generation with Paul and Mia's kids.
That's Fast and Furious 20.
Yeah.
They'll be old enough to drive by then. All right, well, that'll wrap us up, and we'll be right back with Beer 30.
Stay tuned.
Try too fast. Try too furious. I'm too fast for y'all, man. Try too fast. Try too furious. Oh, I'm too fast for y'all. Man. Oh, you just came home. Doing a bid, tell me what you gon' do. Act a fool. Somebody broke in and cleaned out your crib. Boy, what you gon' do? Act a fool. Just bought a new pair and they scuffed your shoes. Tell me what you gon' do. Act a fool. Now them cops trying to throw you in them county blues. Boy, what you gon' do? Act a fool. Talk about gats, traps, cops and robbers. It's 911, please call the doctor. Evacuate the building and trick the pigs. Since everybody want a piece, we gon' split your wig. See some fools slipped up and overstepped their boundaries. You bout to catch a cold, stay the fuck from around me. Your peeps talking about what kind of shit's he on. You'll disappear like poof, bitch be gone. You think 12 gon' catch me? Give me a break. I'm supercharged with a hideaway license plate. It seems they wanna fingerprint me and give me some years. They'll only get one finger while I'm shifting gear.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And we're back with some Beer 30. What are we drinking today, Brad?
Well, in light of our Fast and the Furious episode and the running pun between Belgium and Corona, I have chose for the latter. So today we are drinking the St. Bernardus ABT 12.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've tried the St. Bernardus before. We tried the triple, I believe, in an earlier episode. But the ABT 12 is kind of their flagship beer, and probably one of the best examples of a Belgian and Abbey ale.
Yeah, I mean, this is brewed in the classic quadruple style, and I'm a little bit biased because I have to say this is probably one of the best beers I've ever had in the world, and just because it was Belgium, I had to choose it for this episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's seen as one of the world's best beers. So, like I said, it's definitely, if you've never had a Belgian beer, this you're not going to be disappointed with this
I mean,
one.
Dude, you can't argue with the Tapas Monks. I can't agree with the whole celibacy thing, but when it comes to beer, they know their shizzle.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, the beer pours pretty dark. I would say it's probably an ivory-ish color. What would you?
Yeah, it's definitely dark with a ivory head. It's a bittersweet with a little bit of a hoppy bite. 10% beer, so it's definitely got a higher alcohol content than most of your beers.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I love this beer, I think, because of the complex flavors, because the initial mouthful is pretty, you know, it's sweet, it's kind of fruity to me, but then on the backside, it's, you know, almost a little bit bittersweet, if you will. So it's absolutely, I mean, hands down my favorite beer, so... Yeah.
And the St. Bernardus Brewery has been around since 1946, but it's, I mean, this beer is brewed with some of the original, you know, Tapas Monk recipes that, you know, have been around for freaking ever.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you had to choose, Joe, between a Belgium and a Corona, what are you going for?
I'm definitely going to do a Belgium. I'm not a big... I kind of rank Corona with Bud Light and the other macro brews. I'm just not a fan of the Corona. Maybe if I'm on like a Mexican vacation or something, and yeah, I'll have one. But other than that, no, it's definitely not going to happen.
I mean, that was almost going to be our running joke is, you know, I was going to pour myself the Belgium and then not let Joe in and pour him a Corona and yeah, him.
But I pulled my gun on him and
yeah. I thought better of the situation. I was like, don't tase me. Don't shoot me. You know, it'll be okay. Good beers for everyone. And, you know, the cool thing here is this beer is recommended to be served somewhere between 52 and 56 degrees. And we actually have the St. Bernardus branded glassware and everything else. So we can make sure we didn't go wrong.
So what did you say, chalice style glass?
Yeah, I would say more of a chalice is what we're looking for here. I mean... Dude, these glasses are hard to find, too. You know, occasionally you can find a four-pack of the, you know, assorted varieties of St. Bernardus with one glass. But if you're trying to acquire two or more, I mean, dude, I think I looked on eBay, and even on eBay, the glassware was like $20 a glass. So
just buy a couple four-packs and then, you know, outfit your...
And they're still going to run collection. You about $40.
Hey, but that way you get beer.
Yes. So. You get beer to pour in the glasses, and you can make sure you don't go wrong. But I just can't rave enough about how much I love this beer. And every cigar that I've ever smoked with this beer has, you know, been a wonderful experience. And
yeah, I tried to smoke this beer, but it's just too hard to light.
Well, I mean, you're not trying hard enough. You got to splash it with a little 151.
Oh, okay. Oh, that would be a horrible combination.
No, that's venturing into flesh wound territory, my friend. And go down that dusty road again.
Oh.
So, my opinion is biased here. So, Joe, I'm going to ask you, as far as your official Untappd review, what are you saying?
I mean, this one gets a solid 5 from me.
If I could give it more than 5, I would. So... with no further ado, everybody rush out. I mean, I've seen this beer at Total Wine. I've seen it at a few liquor stores. It should be fairly common to get, so just look for the blue and yellow label.
It's definitely one of the bigger Belgian ales, so you can usually have a problem finding it, you know, anywhere. Definitely take Kurt Russell's advice and try a Belgian beer if you haven't yet.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you choose to buy the sampler, I will say that out of all the St. Bernardus stuff I've drank, I have not had a bad beer from them yet. So, once again, I'm completely biased here, but my favorite beer of all time.
Even better than Guinness?
It's on a different classification. Guinness is my everyday go-to beer because it's economical and it's delicious. This is my... go-to on, hey, it's my Saturday night, I want to sit down with something nice, enjoy my cigar for an hour or so.
And we are recording on a Saturday night, so it's
I am not a liar, my friends.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll be right back with science.
Stay tuned.
Science.
And we're back. Ready for some science.
Hells yeah, dude. I'm ready to get my education on.
Oh, shit, son.
I mean, after we've been doing this for 4 years, do I get an honorary degree or anything?
Oh, yeah, I'll make up a diploma, you know, a bachelor's degree of nerd studies at the University of Cigar Nerds. .com.
Dude, that was pretty good off the cuff. I'm pretty impressed with that. Damn. I mean, that sounds official and shit. So, I mean, that gives us an excuse to throw a Cigar Nerd graduation party. It's too bad folks got to wait 4 years.
Maybe we can order those custom cigar band things I was looking at. And you graduate, here's your Cigar Nerd cigar.
Dude, I'm going to get a cigar cap. It'll be awesome.
All right. back to the lecture at hand. We've talked a lot about in some of our Beer 30 segments the importance of using the right drinkware for your beers and stuff. Well, recently scientists in England at the University of Bristol Tobacco and Alcohol Research Group. Like, I didn't know this was a thing. I mean, if I knew you could actually study alcohol and tobacco in college, I wouldn't have had a criminal justice degree, man. I would have took this course.
Dude, they have also got this awesome course called mixology, and if you get really badass at it, there's some money to be made.
Yes, as I said, Bristol Tobacco and Alcohol Research Group has studied whether or not the shape of your beer glass affects your drinking habits. They were kind of looking at ways to kind of stop excessive drinking and whatnot. And one of the things they came up with is...
Wait a second. You're not going like AMC, like anti-drinking movement on me, are you?
No. So okay. This is something to avoid. But if you want to drink less, they say if you drink from a glass that has like straight sides, like say your regular kitchen glasses, you have
So it'd be like a Pilsner glass or something, maybe?
No. It's like, I'm talking like a straight up, like what you drink your Coke out of at dinner, like just a straight-edged glass, and also glasses that had the like volume measurements on it, like showed you like a third of glass.
You've drank 128 ounces.
Yeah, but they found in the study led by Dr. Angela Atwood that when using glasses that are, like I said, not shaped like your normal beer glasses, and actually putting the volume labels on it, people tend to drink slower or drink less than they were if they were drinking from regular pint glasses or your Pilsner cups or whatever you're choosing.
See, I would like to see the type of beer that we use for the control. Because I think that could play, for me personally, if I'm looking at a glass and it's got an ounce at 32, ounces or something, I'm like, all right, damn, that's quite a bit of beer. But like you said, if I'm drinking,
even that, more than that, they're talking about like actually having like a full, not just the total volume, but seeing the your graduated cylinders in your old lab classes where it had like a all the different measurements up the side. And they did a study. They took 80 men, 80 women, and you ran this test, and the people that were using the non-traditional glasses actually took longer to consume the same amount of alcohol. And then to see if this had any kind of impact in the real world, they took, I think it was like 3 pubs in England, and had them change their beer cell and use, like I said, the recommended glasses for 3 weekends. And they found that they actually sold less beer during those 3 weekends than they do on like a normal night.
That's kind of interesting. Almost perplexing. Like, it's crazy to me how something so subtle can, they're not talking, I'm looking here, folks that, had the Mark glasses finish their beer in about 10.3 minutes compared to 9.1 minutes for the folks with the unmarked glasses. So, I mean, you're not talking a huge substantial difference, but still.
Over time, that's with them, each drinking the same amount. Yes. There's a time difference, but when they did it in the bar setting, it actually hurt sales. I mean, they were selling less alcohol because I guess it took people, longer to drink it. So instead of, the hour that you're there, instead of having 4 beers, you're only having 3. So, I mean, it definitely has some kind of correlation. And even from the Thursday, I mean, there's been times where, you know, I want to have a beer and maybe my beer glasses are dirty and I try to use like a regular kitchen glass and it just, there's something just seems wrong about it, you know, drinking out of like a, you know, my normal.
Well, I wonder if that goes back everyday to, tea glass. You know, as much as we stress about having the proper beer and the proper glassware, I wonder if it just changes the flavor of the beer and you just don't appreciate it and don't enjoy it, so therefore you drink less of it. I mean,
yeah, that's definitely one theory.
That is a, very simplistic, off the cuff.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely one theory because I know we've, you know, having the proper glass for the beer definitely can affect the taste of it.
I mean, that's before we do our beer 30 segment. I mean, what is the first thing we do, you know, to get the beer ready? One, we make sure it's the right temperature. Two, we make sure we're using the recommended glassware. So yeah, I feel like we're, you know, consuming beer at an optimal level more so than,
yeah,
hey, let me just pour this in this one here kitchen glass or go to racetrack and, you know, freaking get you a 64 ounce and pour some beer in there. It's probably not going to do it justice.
Yeah.
Good for rum and Coke, not so much for beer.
Yeah, but if you're, like I said, with this experiment done at like a regular pub, I mean, most of the time you're only going to get like one standard, but you're not going to have like the different selections of glasses like we normally have. You may have either a mug or like your regular, you know, 16 ounce, you know, pint glass. So
I see you're going to the wrong bar.
So, switching it up, that minutely, it's still showing some kind of effect.
Wait, I got to stop you there. What was that word again?
Minutely.
Minutely?
No, minutely. See, I'm the one that pronounces shit correctly.
No, I'm pretty sure I heard a G in there, and I'll go back and replay it. I ain't even scared.
You're hallucinating.
I could be.
Speaking of hallucinations, scientists have figured out how to basically make some like Spider-Man type stuff and increasing the strength of spiders' webs.
Yeah, see, this is an article I can get behind. I mean, mainly the fact that I love tarantulas and have a collection of tarantulas, and
but they don't make webs. So.
Yeah, they do.
They do?
Yes.
I had no idea. I thought tarantulas were just like a ground spider. I didn't know.
No,
they
I mean,
like
there's you have terrestrial tarantulas, which are they prefer the ground, but you know, a lot of them do burrow. You have heavy webbing tarantulas. I mean, there's some that, especially arboreal species that live in trees and stuff like that, when you put them in their enclosure, like their entire enclosure just looks like a massive web with a whole bunch of tunnels running through it. Like it's pretty crazy. I'll show you some pictures and stuff later.
Well, I'll be damned. Well, basically, scientists have been experimenting with this thing called graphene, which is, you know, atom thick sheets of carbon and carbon nanotubes that are, you know, super strong for something so small. That it's on scale with pretty much anything that is naturally produced. And one of the strongest things in nature compared to size or whatnot is spider silk. I mean, they actually make, you know, rope and all kind of stuff out of spider silk because it's considered one of the strongest materials. So they just tried to figure out if they could use this solution to increase the strength of spider silk, and they sprayed, you know, 15 silk slinging spiders with a mixture of water, carbon nanotubes, and water and graphene mixes. And on some of the spiders, there was actually a 3.5 percent increase in the strength of their silk.
That's pretty impressive. I mean, you think about, I mean, I've seen quite a few spiders, especially around the floodlights and stuff like that, and they'll build thick, you know, heavy webs, and it's crazy to see, you know, the size of some of the insects and stuff that you would think how fast you see them flying around, but they hit that web and it's like they've hit a brick wall.
And they say that the spider that had the most increase was the Darwin's bark spider, which apparently these things create huge webs that were like actually cross an entire river and, you know, the jungle and stuff. One of the theories was that, you know, the webs themselves were getting coated in this mixture, but they also, it seems to be that the spiders were actually absorbing the mixture into their bodies and then producing, you know, webs that contain these, you know, nanotubes and, you know, in the actual webs. What they compared it to was like, say your concrete, it's strong compression-wise, but not very torsion. So when they build big buildings and stuff, you sink rebar into the concrete to increase the strength.
Something to reinforce it.
So basically, this is like putting rebar in concrete, but at a, you know, you know, nanoscopic level.
That is very interesting. I hadn't had an opportunity to read the entire article up until now, so I'm just, you know, I mean, it's right up my alley, so I'm just like, holy crap.
So, you know, we figure out a way to create synthetic spider silk. We can, you know, finally become Spider-Man.
That's how I'm going to keep those meddling kids out of my lawn.
I would have got away with it, too, if it wasn't for these meddling kids.
So, you know, all right, I'm down here at the last paragraph where it's talking about the real question, whether or not Spider-Man could actually use this to his advantage. And, you know, it's talking about Peter was a smart kid with access to pretty advanced science. So if he could get his hands on a way to cheaply produce carbon nanotubes, he could mix it into his web shooter formula and hope for the best, or drink billions of them and hope for the best.
Yeah, because that was one of the things I hated about the first series of Spider-Man movies, was he actually produced spider silk. I'm like, no, it's a freaking web shooter thing that he built, and they did that in the, you know, remakes, that it was something that he actually invented. But yeah, that whole him like actually shooting webs out of his hands for real was just kind of stupid.
Yeah.
Lazy filmmaking.
I mean, dude, it takes a considerable investment in technology or CGI, so.
So call up Star Labs.
Quick! Get on the phone. Call them now.
Speaking of labs and whatnot, I was reading some stuff on the International Space Station, and apparently, if you've seen any of the videos that they've posted from the space station, and within this kind of bubble module thing where they have these big windows that they can actually look out on the Earth, I've seen a lot of videos of whatever Mike, how was it, Matsumi or whatever the astronaut yes. that was on there. But apparently the only thing keeping air inside this bubble is tiny O-rings.
I mean, dude, tiny O-rings. I mean, think about a car engine, right? Which is perfect, considering we just came out of, talking about Fast and the Furious. I mean, that is the main thing that a lot of times goes bad, or is, it's a 30-cent, you know, replacement part. However, it's going to take you a good day to tear apart the engine and transmission and everything to get where said sills are.
Or even, you know, I used to play a lot of paintball and stuff, and yeah, most of the, you know, there's a bunch of O-rings in my paintball gun. And those things are usually blowing out, you know, at least every couple of games. So, betting, you know, your life or even the whole space station on the integrity of an O-ring just, you know, that sounds sketchy to me.
I mean, it sounds sketchy, but in retrospect, I would say chances are we're betting our lives on all kinds of little tiny-ass, you know, O-rings or parts and stuff that we probably wouldn't even think about, because we just look at this big, massive project like, oh, sweet. And all of the little things that go into creating the larger thing. Wow, that was very scientific.
Yeah. So I went rappelling one time, and it was like the I'm like, you sure this rope can handle it? Oh, no, this rope can, like, hold 1,000 pounds. I'm like, yeah, but you have duct tape, like, you know, anchoring the rope to whatever it's tied to. Like, oh, that, you know, duct tape will hold 2,000 pounds. So it's like, it's one of those things you don't want to think about. I'm fine if I don't know how the sausage is made. I'm like, I just want to know that I'm not going to go into this tube and die. I don't want to know that there's a 25-cent O-ring, you know, keeping me alive at this point. But
first of all,
as long as I don't know that, I feel perfectly fine.
First of all, I mean, we're talking about space science and everything else here. There's not a 25-cent part.
No, that 25.
Chances are that
25-cent part on Earth costs like $1 million in space.
Probably that little O-ring that they showed that, you know, we're like, man, that's just a rubber compound, is probably like atomized with some kind of freaking, you know,
graphene,
you know, crazy ass substance that they found on some comet that, you know, hasn't even been made publicly known about or something. And
still, it just looks sketchy. And to kind of wrap it up here at the end. You know, I've always been a fan of like shipwreck stories and
pirate
treasures.
No, dude, you've always just been a Yeah, I was going to say pirates, because you're just a fan of booty, all right? Let's just throw it out there. That's all there is to it.
Well, true. But yeah, I mean, that was the things I used to always like watching on Discovery, or even back when I had National Geographic, was some of the scuba photos and stuff. And they've recently discovered a century-old shipwreck with about $150 million worth of gold in it off the coast of Finland. So if you want to look for some gold, yeah, plan your next scuba diving trip to Finland.
I mean, I really think that, you know, we're trying too hard to make it in a blue-collar world. Like, dude, we just got to cut our ties and start diving, or just invest in some metal detectors or something and just start walking around looking for rare minerals. And
yeah.
Either that or, you know, start looking for some whale vomit.
Whale vomit. Oh, yeah, I saw that article about how that's apparently really expensive for some reason.
What is that? Ambrosia or something to that effect?
The ship sunk in 1468, and it was called, this is some Finnish word, but Hanaki Warum, maybe? Don't know. I'm behind on my...
I'll work on my Spanish. You work on your Finnish.
Yeah. But yeah, it sunk in a storm in 1468. Had like 10,000 gold coins and a bunch of jewelry on board, and 1,200 barrels of honey apparently, and 200 parcels of fabric. And like I said, they've just recently rediscovered it. So if anybody's looking for some gold, yeah, head to Finland. And with that, I think that will wrap us up, and we'll be right back with whatever we decide to put next.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to the Nerd News segment. Before we jump into all of the nerdy, geeky details ahead, Joe, I want to ask you, what are some of your final thoughts on the cigar now that we're down to the final third?
I like it. I've not really tried any of the My Father cigars before, and this one's probably not as strong as what I normally smoke, but it's definitely got a good complex flavor to it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely as I started getting down into the second and the third, definitely more of the leather notes and some earthy tones started coming out. You know, overall, I got to say, I was really happy with the smoke. You know, it's a stepping stone for me that I will go out and I will now try some of the other My Father stuff just to experiment and see how I like them.
Sounds good to me. So what kind of news you got for us this week?
Well, we just wrapped up, you know, talking about Fast and the Furious, and we touched on it a little bit in the main segment. But Fast and the Furious 8 has an official 2017 release date, and I believe that is going to be
April something or another.
Yes, April.
Yeah, it was in my my show notes, but not my news notes.
Yep,
April 14th, 2017.
So, you know, very, very close to, you know, the last 2 years of release dates as far as, you know, the theatric releases.
So sometime between Marvel movies, we'll get another Fast and the Furious.
So, I mean, that'll be a good break. I mean, it'll be, you know, going from superheroes to superheroes with badass cars.
Yeah. And as I believe I said earlier, that, you know, what little we know about the story so far is, probably going to take place in New York. Kurt Russell's character is going to have a bigger part in this one. And actually, that's about all we know at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, though, guess what else comes out around this time?
What's that?
So we've got Ghost in the Shell, the live-action movie, as well as Pacific Rim 2. So this movie's going to have some competition. So yeah. I wonder if we're going to, you know... I'm by no means going to say the movie isn't going to be successful, but I wonder, you know, if that's going to play in the box, or if everybody's just going to have to shell out money for three times the movies.
Probably. I mean, that April time slot, it's kind of before the big summer movies start, because we're going to have probably a Marvel movie in around May. So, yeah, a lot of our big superhero movies that normally dominate the summer won't be coming out until May, July time. So I think it's gonna be early enough that it's gonna hit that that big thing. You know, these other movies that are coming out, well, you know, Pac Rim's a sequel, but The Ghost in the Shell are not, I would say, proven movies at this point, so there might be not as much anticipation. I mean, if Seven made like I said, $1.4 billion. So I see this one not bombing.
I don't think it's going to bomb. I mean,
they just keep getting like, you know, bigger and bigger. So it's, I think they're going to do okay.
Absolutely. That's my thoughts. The next thing I got, we're going to switch gears a little bit and go into kind of a little bit geekier side of things. So
can we get geekier at this point? We tend to get pretty geeky.
I mean, yeah, we're going to get a little technical, I guess.
We can get technical.
So I know you're a big fan of the Oculus. I mean, out of everybody I talk to.
I mean, I've always wanted to live in a virtual world. The real world sucks. I want to log into the Matrix or
the Oasis.
Yeah, the Oasis, and you know, live life there for a while. That, and like I said, I've always been a big video gamer, and I think the Oculus has the potential to really give you that immersive experience.
Oh, dude, it's
going to
revolutionize. I mean, the gaming industry and.
And the porn industry, too.
There we go. We almost made it through an entire show where I think we might have been able to avoid the explicit tag, but
never.
There it is.
Well, I mean, as you see, the porn industry, especially when the internet is concerned, has always been the forefront of technology. I mean, the being able to buy stuff online, that kind of started, you know, streaming video, that all that started with...
The
porn industry, yeah. I mean, 30% of the internet is porn-related if from some of the recent stats I saw. So, you know, sooner or later... I mean, that's the reason why Beta and VHS back then, you know, porn went with VHS, and that's kind of why, even though Beta was more was a better system, and even with Blu-ray versus the high-def or whatever HD video, like I said, the industry kind of follows that... That industry always has a big effect when it comes to technology. So sooner or later, there's going to be a freaking Oculus Rift porno. It's foregone. There's a lot of perverts in Japan who program this shit. It's going to happen. I'm saying that now.
Well, my friend, we're going to have to build you a little bit beefier PC than the one you're currently running. So you've been
the one that doesn't run.
Well, I mean, you've been, you know, Brad, I need you to build me a damn computer. This thing's a piece of crap, blah, blah, blah. Well... All right, the recommended specs for the Oculus have come out. So basically,
we have gotten a release date for that. It's coming out like maybe January of next year. So we're in you're close to your virtual reality, and like I said, all the other competing systems that they're trying to also make this, either the end of this year, early next year. So it's coming, folks. So you better upgrade your systems now.
Yep. So, you know, you're going to, obviously, one of the big driving forces behind this, as well as any gaming machine, is the graphics processing unit. So, you know, the GPU, and here they're recommending either the NVIDIA GTX 970 or the AMD 290 equivalent or higher. I'm going to get a little bit more technical and say that, you know, at some point, I wonder if the developers, since this is going to be built open source, if there's going to be SLI support, and basically what that means
for people that don't know what the NVIDIA GTX is, what's the specs of this, you know, video card?
This video card here is, give me one second, I got to look up the individual.
We're looking at that up, processor, it's saying you want at least Intel i5 processor.
Yep.
Running 8 gigs of RAM, HDMI 1.3 output, two USB, at least 3.0 ports, Windows 7 or higher computer. So it's not super, super top of the line, but... You're definitely want to, you know, the big thing is probably going to be the video card, but the rest of that stuff is most people already have these specs in their computers, if not a little bit better at this point, if you're buying a brand new system.
Yeah. I mean, for most folks, they'll probably be able to scoot by on the processor. I mean, the biggest thing, if you're an avid PC gamer, everybody knows that the video card is going to be the driving force behind that, and then having a power supply big enough to power that puppy. So what you're looking at here is, you know, a 7 gigabytes per second memory clock with 4 gigs of standard memory config. This is built on a GDDR5 memory interface and has a 224 memory bandwidth, or 224 gigabyte per second memory bandwidth. So this thing is a absolute powerhouse.
Yeah, they're saying if you don't already have a computer for this, to build a system from scratch is going to run you around $1,000.
Yeah, I mean, I can say somebody like you that's going to be like, Brad, build me a computer. By the time I get you the case, the video card, the hard drives, you know, the beauty is with modern technology, individual computer components like hard drives, RAM, processors, everything has come down dramatically in price. Yeah. So,
and you know, if you're already running some kind of high-end gaming PC, it's going
to
handle the
Yeah, rest. I mean, as long as you've got the necessary ports to do, and that's the beauty of building a gaming PC, as newer technology and stuff progresses, you're able to upgrade. Whereas if you were to go to a big box store and just buy, you know, the beefiest e-machines you could from Walmart, just as an example, unfortunately, you're not going to have a lot of the, you know, the number of ports and the expansion capabilities that you might need later on as more advanced functions of the Oculus or, you know, other games release. I mean, by and large, most people are building their gaming rigs and everything. And usually, if you take care of it, you're going to get a good 6-7 years before you're going to need to upgrade, as long as you go in with that initial investment.
Yeah, and if you don't have enough ports in your computer, there is a pretty awesome Darth Vader computer port I saw online the other day with a bunch of extra USB.
Yep, and that's going to be the thing, is, you know, here you're going to need at least two dedicated USB 3.0 ports to process the, you know, the camera functions, as well as, you know, some of the other stuff, the Oculus. So, you know, if you don't already, start getting your budgets in line. And, Joe, this should excite you, because I haven't got to do a good gaming PC build in a while. So this might get us an opportunity to play with some water cooling and some other cool things, because here's the other thing you got to keep in
mind,
folks.
Built in humidor and
yeah, absolutely. Well, with your gaming rigs, they generate a lot of heat, and heat, dust, and electronics don't bode very well. So you got to find a way to keep that puppy cool. So that's the other reason why I typically recommend custom builds, because I can control the number of fans, and with the custom motherboards, you get all kinds of, you know, BIOS options, so you can control fan speeds, voltage going to your processor, start getting into the overclocking and more advanced functions.
And with this Oculus, I mean, we were talking about some of the racing games. I mean, playing the new, like, Need for Speed or whatever in the Oculus is going to look like you're sitting in the freaking driver's seat of the car.
I mean, just
it's
wait, dude.
Awesome.
Wait till they get you a chair that's on a gyroscope or something. So as you're, yes, like, barrel rolling your car, your chair is rolling, and you're going to have barf bags and stuff strapped to your face.
Or playing old school X-Wing on the freaking Oculus. So, like, I would never leave my house. All right, so what else we got?
Up next, we've got the Flash Arrow spinoff project and
Legends of Tomorrow.
And
I don't know when it's gonna. I've heard it's gonna be kind of. It's not gonna. It may be a mid season start, but we've got our first trailer preview of that. They're introducing the character of Rip Hunter, the rogue time traveler guy who basically. The future has gone to shit, so he's come back to the past to put together a team of heroes to prevent the bad shit that's going to happen in the future. And like I said, Arrow and Flash are probably going to be involved at some point, but the Atom that we've seen on Arrow, he's definitely in it. They're bringing back the girl who played Black Canary, who died this season. Is somehow she's coming back to life. From the trailer, it looks like it's the Lazarus Pits bringing her back. She's now the White Canary. Firestorm is going to be in it. Captain Cold and whatever the fire guy is. Like, so
I mean, just to give you
a team
synopsis,
of heroes and villains.
It is basically going to be the DC version of Avengers, I think. You know, is kind of what I'm envisioning
yeah,
in my head.
It's the TV version of Justice League. You know, so before we actually get the Justice League movie, whenever that's coming out, we're basically going to have the.
I mean,
TV
I wish
version.
You know I. Granted, the CW, I dig Flash and Arrow. I wish Netflix would do a series. I mean, just that way they didn't have the limitations of for network TV and to see what some of the creators could do. Because that was one of the things about Arrow is I was like, man, I just wish that you know, we could just step it up a couple of notches. Yeah. But that's...
But especially, I mean, the CW DC shows compared to the other DC shows we've had seen on other networks, it's a lot more comic booky, especially,
yes,
especially,
I mean,
Flash.
Well, I mean, a lot of the characters, I mean, they date back to, you know, you were talking about, you know, the Traveler specifically. I mean, I think that dates back to, you know, the 1959 comic or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for...
And the guy who's playing it is the same guy who played Rory on
Doctor Who.
Yes. So he's already got experience as a time traveler. Which he kind of looked like Tenet, too, because in the trailer he's wearing like a badass trench coat and stuff.
I don't know. Can we see Billy Piper, you know, maybe do, you know, a scene or two in here? I mean...
or Karen Gillan,
yeah.
guest star. One of his... That's one thing I've liked about the Flash series. It's like almost like a different bad guy each week, so it very is almost like a comic book. You know, it's definitely, you know, Arrow kind of did that when it started off, but the last, you know, season or so, it's kind of been maybe.
Yeah,
one,
I mean, it's mainly focused on, you know, your key players,
Ra's al Ghul and stuff. But yeah, like say, Flash is still doing that. You know, it's almost like a Monster of the Week type show. There's like a different bad guy each week.
Absolutely. Up next we've got you know, a little bit of a contract conflict going on. Harry Shearer, the voice of Mr. Burns, Ned Flanders, The Simpsons. I mean, this guy's been, you know, part of the Simpsons voices, you know, for 26 years now. But, you know, apparently he's looking to try to get paid on more of the merch and stuff.
Yeah,
of
the
that
dude does half the voices on the show, so
yes.
I can see where he wants a little bit more money because he's probably doing more work than the rest of the cast.
Absolutely. So, you know, I know James L. Brooks has been tweeting, hey, I know we couldn't come to an agreement, but let's keep trying. So hopefully they're able to get everything resolved, because as many voices as that guy does, I don't know how you know, fill in from there. I mean, you can't just get rid of all of those characters. I mean,
and but at this point, it's gone on 26 years. I mean, maybe it's about time to finish it up.
Well, I mean, I think they just renewed not too long ago for at least another two seasons. So I don't know. I mean, a lot of folks are with you that, hey, this show probably should have been ended 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I've not watched a new Simpsons, and I don't know when. It's just, but yeah, it's. I think at this point they've got to be running out of stories at this point.
Nah, man. I mean, you go to the South Park route, kind of, you know, just continue to play on today's current events and make it fun. And I don't know. But at the same time, I'm a little bit conflicted because I'm like, yeah, just let some of the good childhood memories
yeah.
just be memories. Don't try to bring back the original nostalgia because it just isn't there.
Yeah.
Kind of keeping with talking about nostalgia and things coming back. Have you seen the trailer for the Muppet Show reboot?
I have, and it looks awesome. I mean,
dude, it's like a you know, Muppets meets The Office or
something. Yeah, even the logo looks a lot like the Office logo that they've showed in the trailer, and it's basically they're starting a new Muppet Show, and this is kind of filmed like a reality show behind the scenes of them making their new Muppet show.
You know, what I've watched of the trailer and stuff, like, there's definitely, it's not necessarily a kid's show.
No.
I mean, it's...
Well, the original, I believe the original was actually a primetime show, and it, from what I remember of it, had kind of a little bit more adult humor, but this one, like I said, it really goes full on in that. And the original show, too, was mainly kind of a behind the scenes of their theater show at this point. So it's kind of in that same theme as the original. But yeah, I mean, in the trailer, Kermit makes a joke about the band. He's like, yeah, the band's always been happy, and now they can do it legally.
Yes. You know, the other part is I like. Apparently him and Miss Piggy have separated, but he's with
another pig. He's like, what can I say? I like pigs.
Yeah.
Then he says, like, she made my life a bacon wrapped hell. I can't wait. I'm shut up and take my money now. I'm sold on this.
I have big hopes for this because Bill Prady, the co-producer of The Big Bang Theory, is co-writing and executive producing along with Bob Kuschel from from Anger Management. So I think it's going to be awesome.
Do we have a release date yet?
2015, but yeah.
Sometime in the fall,
I assume. Still, but at this point, being pretty tight-lipped, yeah. So there's nothing.
The Henson Company always makes good stuff, and even there, they have an adult wing, too, where they do more explicit humor, and some of that stuff I've seen they've put up on YouTube is absolutely hysterical. They did a thing with Nerdist last year, something like that, with Neil Patrick Harris, and I mean, it was hilarious. I can't wait to see the Muppets come back.
Absolutely. The next thing that I read earlier today that I thought was pretty cool was Gary Anthony Williams has been cast as Bebop in the upcoming Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2.
Yeah, I can't wait because, like I said, I was a huge fan of the old cartoon series. And I mean,
Bebop and Rocksteady, yeah. Dude. I mean,
when they brought in whatever Tokar and Rezar in the original movies, I was like, why the hell is it not Bebop and Rocksteady? If you're going to bring mutants in, like, bring Bebop and Rocksteady. And now, like, they haven't cast Rocksteady yet, but. And we know Bebop and Rocksteady, and also Tyler Perry is going to be in it as Baxter. What's his name?
Yeah, I think it was just Mr. Baxter is how they referred to him. Basically, the wasp type creature.
Yeah, he was.
Scientist Baxter Stockman.
That's it, Baxter Stockman. Yeah, he's another character from the cartoons, and we've already talked about Stephen Amell playing Casey Jones. So I can't wait to see this this version.
Absolutely. So I mean, you know, the original film grossed more than $485 million worldwide. So, dude, I think just the combination of Bebop and Rocksteady,
yeah.
You're gonna have a lot of people just want that nostalgia over again.
And back to superhero news, we've got our first trailer for CBS's Supergirl series is going to be coming out in the fall.
Yes, I watched that earlier today as well. I did not include that in my notes for some reason, but you got any more details to share with us or anything on that one? Or just...
No, not really. I haven't heard like when it's I'm assuming in the fall as most stuff will be, but yeah, the trailer looks pretty cool. It's you know, like I said, just about every station has a freaking DC show now, so I'm looking forward to seeing this. I mean, it looks hilarious. Some of the stuff from the trailer of her trying to figure out how to be like she's trying to figure out the costume, and her buddy's like, you know, why do you want a cape? Capes are stupid. And then it shows her like in a car chase, and the car makes a turn, and she can't make the turn and runs into like a wall. And he's like, oh, capes add aerodynamics for flight control.
Well, I think that's, you know, one thing I've seen as far as a few memes pop up after the, you know, Supergirl announcement was the restroom signs that shows, you know, just the basic, you know, shadow figure of a woman in a dress. Well, now everybody's like, holy crap, it was never a dress all along. It was a cape. So
I say I went to the mall the other day and the men's bathroom sign was a dude in a pimp hat and a cane. I was like, is this like pimp bathroom only?
That's the one where they use the gold bars of soap.
Yeah.
So that's what I've got for nerd news for this episode.
All right. Well, that'll wrap us up. Remember to check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. Go like our Facebook page. Check us out on Twitter at CigarNerdPod. Also, we have a Instagram account now, which is also at CigarNerdPod. And with that, just remember, you got to live your life 10 seconds at a time.
Absolutely. And just real quick, our Untappd official page is up, live, active, and that is at Cigar Nerds.
Any final thoughts or shout-outs?
Yeah, shout-outs to everybody that keeps making my my movie dreams come true.
Also, shout-out to hurryupandtakemymoney.com. I found a lot of cool stuff on there that I hate Mike for sending me that link because now I want to spend all my money. All right, and since I already did the quote, good night. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.